Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How often have you heard people lament the fact they did not ask more questions of family members who have passed away, taking with them important details of family histories? It's a relatively common regret. There is an ongoing effort in our area to preserve those histories by asking everyone, especially young people, to ask more family history questions. And the holiday season, when families are typically together, is a good time to do just that. Every year since 2005, a local organization has been encouraging youngsters to record family stories. Many of them are then selected for publication. We'll be hearing some of those stories on today's program. With me in studio are two women who encourage the gathering of family histories through the Granny Annie Story Celebration, founding executive director Connie McIntyre and founding associate director Fran Hamilton. Each year we invite them back so they can encourage youngsters to get involved. Also with us is Martha Stegmeier, director of the St. Louis Public Schools Springboard Partnership at Springboard, which provides programs in the arts, humanities, and sciences to schools. Ladies, so nice to have you with us.
Hi, Don.
Thank you.
Hi, Don.
I always know when Thanksgiving is close because this program gets scheduled just before. Not a coincidence, because that's the time, as I mentioned, when families get together. But thanks for being with us. Connie, let me start with you. Let's remind our listeners who may not be familiar with Granny Annie, who Granny Annie was and what this program is really all about and how it works.
Well, thank you, Don. Granny Annie is named after my friend Ann Cutler, who I worked with over a period of years to save and share many stories from her family's history. We put together 5 volumes of stories from her family's history, primarily because her mother was a fantastic storyteller. And I watched how she shared those stories and what that meant, not only to the family, to the person whose story was being recorded, but also to the entire community. And I kind of kept that in my mind as I continued to work with family stories through the years. And when Fran and I started talking about a writing opportunity and publishing opportunity for young people, it was kind of a natural choice when we were looking for a topic that would be meaningful to the children and worthy of their time and effort. And we both agreed right away that recording family stories would really be a great choice for this project. And it has been.
Tell me something about the process, how it works, how you get the kids involved, and how they get to the point of potential publication.
Okay, well, each year we invite students from anywhere. We are located in St. Louis. We're a nonprofit. And we invite people, like I said, students from anywhere in the world to submit stories from their family's history. And we have a website that a lot of people are able to find and then respond to. And then, of course, by word of mouth, more and more families and schools have been taking part as the years have gone by. This is our 9th year in sharing family stories this way. So the word is getting around, and we're happy about that because it's such a rich experience. So, as I said, each year we invite students to interview someone in their family, learn something that they find interesting about their family's history, and write a short story about it. And we encourage them to share it with their family and with their classmates and their communities and lots of different ways. And then we invite them to share their story with the Granny Annie and have it considered for possible publication. So then each spring, we have produced a new volume of Granny Annie stories. We are faced each year with the very difficult process of deciding which stories will be published because they're all just so wonderful in so many different ways. But our volume of paperback volume of Granny Annie family stories has come out each May, and this year will be our 9th volume.
Fran Hamilton, would we call this a competition?
Not really. It's a publishing opportunity for young people. And whenever people submit for publication, in a way they're competing. They're competing for a publication spot. And in a way, perhaps they're competing with other writers for that spot. But we really avoid calling it a contest. There have never been winners. We've never awarded anything like first place or second place or a prize or anything like that. Students are published or they aren't. And we really encourage the celebration of stories even before they're published or even whether or not they're published in the Granny Annie. We encourage sharing of stories in a community, and sometimes local newspapers print the stories, Sometimes stories are read over the school intercom, or there are events at a school that really celebrates and shares the stories that students write.
You know, this business of being inquisitive about families' histories, it seems to me, is becoming something of a lost art, perhaps because there are so many distractions for young people today. But this is also something that would apply to older people who forget to ask grandparents, for instance, older relatives about their families.
Right. There are so many things competing for people's time. And I think as people get older, their sense changes of what's really important, and family stories become more important as they realize that the time is running short to get the information, or sadly, sometimes they don't realize until it's too late.
I'll bet that the vast majority of people listening to this program right now includes many, many people who wish they had asked more questions at some point in their lives. Martha, let me turn to you. It's already been mentioned that the schools are involved in all of this. What is the school's role?
Well, the school's role, first of all, a classroom teacher may decide to do this project. And so she can or he can essentially charge his or her students with going home during Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah vacation, and talking to the story keeper of the family and bringing back maybe a couple of stories. And then the teacher can walk them through the process of actually writing the story, including dialogue, making sure that the sequence of events is proper and in good order, using sensory detail, a narrator, having a good conclusion at the end of the story. However, although it certainly works well with the curriculum and is part of the state Common Core state standards, it also can be done really in a home setting, a homeschool setting, you know, especially if parents would like to sort of guide that process.
How does it fit in with the core standards exactly?
Don, thank you for asking that question. The Common Core state standards for the English language arts writing section, I quote, "One of the main goals of this, of the writing, is," and this is for grades 4 through 8, which is the grade of the students who were involved in the Granny Annie, "is write narratives to develop real or imagined experiences or events using effective technique, descriptive details, and clear event sequences." Hmm. It absolutely fits perfectly.
So if they weren't doing it for the Granny Annie project, they'd have to be doing it for something else. I mean,
this is
very convenient.
They would. Yeah, yeah. And how meaningful this project is.
Sure. Connie, back to you with regard to the notion of the family storyteller. We've talked about this in past programs, but it is fascinating. Most families generally do have at least one, maybe only one.
That's true, and it's been fun through the years to hear different families report back on that. And so often it is an older member of the family, but not always. And it seems that each storyteller kind of has their own flair, if you might call it that, of how they tell their story. And it's interesting to see that sometimes come through in the students' writing. And along with that is just the connections between that student and that storyteller. Once they've really shared a story that's important to the family, it creates a bond for them and brings the whole family kind of closer together, which is the really wonderful aspect of the Granny Annie.
Can I just add to that, Connie? So we had a Meet the Author event and Meet the Illustrator event, as we do each year down at Left Bank Books in June. And it was wonderful to see who packed Left Bank Books. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, and when I introduced the students who were going to be reading their stories, the one about whom the story was, okay, not so good grammar on that. I might not make the Granny Annie cutoff. But anyway, the main character in the story often wanted me to introduce them as well. So-and-so grandfather is here from Foley, Minnesota, and so on, because they were proud that their story will live on and that student thought enough about it to write it down.
Fran, does it change the kids? Have you noticed that the kids, after having gone through this experience, are somehow different?
Sometimes it changes them dramatically. Sometimes, well, we've heard from some teachers that The Granny Annie provides an opportunity for some kids to shine that may not often have that opportunity. Everybody has the potential for a family story. So they're starting with an equal playing field. And sometimes people on the selection committee, people who help us select the stories that we publish, read some of the stories and they say, well, this couldn't have been written by a child. And we remind them that the story was told to them by an adult. And so they're starting with, depending on the adult, of course, they may be starting with a very well-told story, and their job is to record it, to perhaps select details that they're going to include or enhance or leave out. So they're starting. There are also other ways, too, in which young people are changed. Just the idea that they've been published authors or published illustrators can be very important to them. And being a published illustrator sometimes and attending an event as a published illustrator sometimes takes precedence over attending a sporting event.
That's an interesting facet of all of this. Mm-hmm. We're going to be listening to a couple of those stories in a few minutes after a break and also be talking with a teacher who was the teacher of record when one of those stories was written and recorded. But, Connie, before we take that break, let me come back to you with regard to the full gamut of stories. You know, I think people would tend to think, well, these are all going to be stories about grandfathers surviving World War II or grandmom coming over on a boat from the old country, and if she hadn't done that, the family wouldn't be here. But the point is much finer than that on many of the stories.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because sometimes people think of family stories strictly as what you just said, that, you know, the history of where the family came from. But what we're looking at with the Granny Annie is those stories that the family remembers and passes down and maybe cries over, but maybe laughs together over through the years, because those are all aspects of being a family together. And yes, we have stories from World War II. Yes, we have stories from the Holocaust. We also have stories about apartheid this year and you know, natural disasters. But in addition to that, we get a lot of stories about just what it's like to be a young person growing up and playing in the finals basketball game and being chosen to play. And maybe a story about just growing up in the neighborhood and what it's like, some experience that an ancestor had in their neighborhood. So the stories can be almost anything. They can certainly be adventure or drama or humor or you name it.
Well, we're going to do more than name it. We're going to listen to a couple of them when we come back. We have to take that break. We're talking about the annual Granny Annie Family Story Celebration. That is a project whereby young people in particular can preserve family histories by talking to the older members of the family and learning more about them and about, as I say, the history of the family. With me in studio are Connie McIntyre and Fran Hamilton. They're the co-founders of the Granny Annie Family Story Celebration. Also with us is Martha Stegmeyer, director of the St. Louis Public Schools Springboard Partnership. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the need to preserve our family's histories. It's something we do every year at this time on St. Louis Public Radio and on St. Louis on the Air, because this is when families are typically getting together for Thanksgiving, a little bit later Christmas, and Hanukkah, of course. With me in studio are Connie McIntyre and Fran Hamilton, who are co-founders of the Granny Annie Family Story Celebration. Also, Martha Stegmeyer, director of the St. Louis Public Schools Springboard Partnership. Connie, I'll turn to you once again, because we have a young man by the name of Miles Bassett, I believe it is, and you can set up his story for us.
I'm delighted to. Miles R. Bassett wrote a Granny Annie story last year when he was a fifth grader at Conway Elementary School in Ladue School District. And he's going to be reading his story, which was published in Granny Annie Volume 8. The title of the story is Remember Me. Miles is the great-grandson of Gertrude, who is the primary character in this story. Gertrude is portrayed in three short vignettes within this story that really portray her spirit. And we were excited to read this story, and I think the listeners will enjoy it too. It took place between 1926 and 1928, first in Warsaw, Poland, and then ends up in Brooklyn, New York, USA. So here's Miles' story. Miles R. Bassett, the author of Remember Me.
Gertrude, they're going to kill you, Gertrude's friend shouted frantically. I don't care, Gertrude Bluestein answered abruptly. Then Gertrude walked off to the very small, one-room schoolhouse with a gorgeous facade of oak wood. The wood came out of the facade into an arch. Under the oak arch there was a moderate-sized, rusty brass bell. Then the petite 16-year-old Jewish girl with brown hair, pale skin, and big brown eyes reached for the rusty old brass doorknob. She turned the knob and walked in. She gaped at the willowy teacher with pale skin, green eyes, and gray hair in a bun. The teacher turned toward her and asked, "What do you want?" Her voice was like a cat's claws on a chalkboard. Gertrude went into her best posture and answered, "I want to learn." The teacher pointed to an old oak desk as she responded, "Go sit down, then." Gertrude walked over to the old oak desk and learned. A couple of years later, a Polish man from the New World came to find a bride from the shtetl, meaning small Jewish village. The man, whose name was William, had brown hair and hazel eyes. He was tall and slender. William, from America, had arranged to marry Gertrude's cousin, but when William looked at Gertrude, it was love at first sight. The two lovebirds eloped, and by the time Gertrude was 18, she was packing to go to the New World. As Gertrude approached the monstrous ship, she held her protruding stomach and thought about her unborn baby. She gazed upon the huge steel steamboat, then she looked up at a large smokestack that was puffing black smoke. She boarded third class, or steerage, which was exceptionally cramped. She looked down at the old redwood and realized that she did not feel well and started vomiting. As 3 days passed, the hurtling got worse, so she went to see the captain. She gazed at the captain with his gray beard, green eyes, and large scar next to his right eye. She looked him in the eye and spoke with a firm voice, "I want to be moved to first class." The captain was shocked at the tiny Jewish girl. "Okay, then, you will be moved from steerage to first class." Later that day, she got to sit at the captain's table with all the other first-class passengers. She thought about her life in the New World. They eventually made it to Ellis Island. When Gertrude arrived, she couldn't find William. She realized that he was in the third-class steerage line, and she was in first class, so Gertrude took a lengthy walk and saw William. She tapped him on the shoulder and whispered, "Remember me?"
Miles spoke with producer Alex Hoyer after reading that story and told Alex how he learned about that particular tale.
My grandma always kind of twisted the story with Gertrude, and I was always a little curious how it turned out, because it kind of got different as you became older, according to my mom. So I went to her and asked the story, and my grandmother told me the whole story, and I wrote down, and she helped me through the whole process.
And the story that you wrote, is it completely nonfiction, or is some of it fiction? Did you expand or take poetic license with some of the details?
That's where it kind of becomes a little funky, because my great-grandmother always, as I said, she changed it a little. She made it sound how she wanted it to sound. So that may not be the accurate depiction, but that's the closest depiction my grandmother could get.
What did you think of the story?
I thought it was interesting. Because at this time, I was learning about immigration, so I decided to use facts like Ellis Island. And, like, I always heard stories about how she learned English from my grandfather's textbooks. And she was, as I heard, a brilliant woman.
She must have been pretty strong to be over in Europe and to mm-hmm. make her way aboard this ship.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from the entire experience?
I learned that she was a pretty tough woman, and she went up to the captain and even said, "I want to be moved to first class." She said, "I wanted to learn."
in your writing, I noticed that you use a lot of description. One of the parts that stuck out to me was willowy teacher with pale skin, green eyes, and gray hair in a bun. That creates a real image in my head. Talk about how you wrote this.
Well, we were doing something called Word Masters, and it's like a bunch of analogies, and they give you these words and the definitions, and you kind of have to like learn the words so you can do the analogies. And I remember facade was one of them, and willowy, so I kind of used some of those in the writing.
And that's young Miles Bassett talking about his submission for the Granny Annie project, I'll call it that, not a competition, which was titled Remember Me. We have Katie Moynihan with us on the line. She was Miles Bassett's fifth grade teacher at Conway Elementary in the Ladue School District when he wrote that story. She's now at Ladue's fifth grade center teaching communications arts and social studies. Katie, thanks so much for being with us.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
What a mature young man. He was a fifth grader at the time. I'm really very impressed with his maturity.
Yeah, he's a pretty great kid.
Well, now, how much help, Katie, did you give him on this? I mean, he really did very, very well, but as Alex pointed out in the interview, he was using some language we don't often associate with fifth graders.
He did a wonderful job. I don't give them a lot of help other than really guiding them through the writing process. The interview they did prior to our classwork, they did that over winter vacation. And when they came back, they pretty much had their topic picked out. At that point, we started just pre-writing and drafting some stories. Along the way, I helped them revise and edit, but the words are all theirs. And the ideas are all his and, of course, his grandmother's.
Another great line was talking about the sound of like a cat's paw on a chalkboard.
Figurative language, yeah, we learned a lot about that.
Yeah, and Martha Stegmaier here is talking about what an important asset this particular Granny Annie project is to teachers like yourself and to the school curriculum.
It really is wonderful. One of our writing pieces that we do is narrative, and usually they just write a personal narrative, but in this way they can actually write a narrative using their talking with their families and using family history. And being able to share something about themselves and their family with not only the class, but even possibly in a book.
What is the value of this program in your words?
I really like it because it helps the students take part in a meaningful writing experience. This not only, you know, allows them to use the descriptive language we've been learning about and the figurative language, and you know, I'm glad Miles brought in the word masters because that's one of the vocabulary things we do. But it really just lets them share something about themselves with their classmates in a meaningful way.
So are we going to continue this? You have a new assignment, a new school now. Is this something you're dealing with communication skills? You going to continue with this?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, Katie, thanks so much for being with us and telling us a little bit more about Miles and his story and the school's role in all of this. Congratulations to you for being his editor, and he winds up getting published. How about that?
Well, it was wonderful.
Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies, what do you think? I mean, that was a mature young man who put that together, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and we're constantly impressed with the writing that young students across the country and beyond are able to produce. It's inspiring. And I was really so happy to hear Katie Moynihan talk about the value that the Granny Annie has for teachers who are trying to help students practice certain skills and learn certain skills. It's nice to have the Granny Annie recognized that way. The Granny Annie has also been recognized by the Missouri Arts Council. We have received financial assistance for our project again this year from the Missouri Arts Council, which is a state agency. And for the first time this year, we have received support from the Regional Arts Commission. So we are really pleased to be able to share that information and to know that we're on track in so many ways, not only in the personal and family and community support that the Granny Annie provides, but also educationally and artistically.
Fran, you know, people may not always think of how important it is to hone those communication skills. It all begins with writing, really, doesn't it? Being able to communicate and do so effectively.
It's hard to know where the beginning really is because reading provides a good foundation for writing. People see how language is used in writing and in speaking, and then they imitate that in their own composition. The Granny Annie also was featured in The Reading Teacher, which is the journal of the International Reading Association. And Danielle L. Defoe, the author of the article, mentioned how contests and publishing opportunities help to prepare students for standardized writing assessments. And the reasons that she cited for that was that it provided students with practice dealing with assigned prompts and selecting and crafting their own personal response to that prompt and blending the explanatory and narrative writing. In addition, they get practice writing for a distant audience. And although the standardized writing assessment is testing particular skills that they develop, the context of the writing that they do for that, it helps to practice for it so that they are getting a prompt and they are thinking of writing for someone they may not know and meeting assigned guidelines and expectations. In addition, contests and publishing opportunities like the Granny Annie generate a large number of short student-written mentor texts that student writers can read and study and then imitate. So all of those are very valuable. And the Granny Annie has hundreds of student-written stories on our website.
Martha Stegmeier, is writing becoming a lost art among students today, young people? I mean, they're tweeting and they're doing things that really don't necessarily hone the writing skills.
I think one of the things that teachers are really working with students on is things like who is your audience and choosing details depending on what your purpose is for writing. But as was said earlier, when students know who will be reading their writing, it makes all the difference in the world. And to see the effect of their writing on those who read it is really a lesson that I think stays with them for the rest of their life, that what they have to say is powerful, that they have the power to connect with people, to change minds, to delight, to entertain, et cetera, and also make history come alive.
Yeah, and that's, we have to come back to that. I mean, that's what this
yes.
is really all about. But certainly the ability to write and communicate that way is an important skill. So you're really getting a twofer here. Connie, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just kind of chuckling to myself because we talk so much in this program and in the Granny Annie about history. It's all about family history. And early on in the, I don't know if it was the first or second year, we came upon a really basic question that we had a little trouble defining, and that is what's classified as history? And what we came to understand is that anything, and this is how the Granny Annie now defines history for the purposes of the Granny Annie, and that is that anything that happened before that author was born is considered history. And so I just really chuckle each year as the stories start coming in and we see that the dates that the stories took place, and then we're in the 2000s now for story dates. But truly, those are history to the young people who are writing them.
This may be an unfair question. I'll start with you on this, Fran, with regard to all the stories that you've looked at over the years. Is there a single story in all of this time, 8 years, that maybe stands out amongst all the rest? Is that an unfair question?
There are several. There are several that stand out. Yeah. Some stand out for their humor. Some stand out perhaps for their emotional impact. Some just for the triumph that people in the story experienced. I couldn't say one, but there are some that stand out above others.
You couldn't and you wouldn't. I think it was an unfair question, but I'm going to put it to Connie, too.
Well, and I'm going to follow Fran's lead and defer because I love all the stories we get. But one thing that Fran's comment brought to mind for me is that sometimes there are stories that stand out in my memory because they are stories about poor decisions that family members made in the past. I mean, clearly, often the stories are about triumph, as Fran mentioned, and about some heroic or worthy act that an ancestor is remembered for. But I think it is really important to remember that we all make mistakes. And not only are those worthy of being remembered and passed down, they are critical because our young people today need to know that people do make mistakes and it's okay and you can get past them and move on. At the time, you might not think so, but you do. And that's an important message we can pass on to our young people as well.
Martha?
Just one other thing. So many of the schools have character education programs. I know that Dewey International Studies Elementary School has a program where every month, they read a different story across the curriculum for preschool all the way up to fifth grade on a different character ed trait. So it might be perseverance, or it might be dedication, or compassion, or empathy. And I was just thinking how wonderful some of these stories would be to read over the PA during that month.
Well, we have to take a break and come back with yet another story. This one does not involve a well-known historic event or history in the sense that we've been talking about it here in some cases. It's rather just kind of a personal thing that happened, but a history nonetheless. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment as we continue with St. Louis on the Air. My guests in studio, Connie McIntyre and Fran Hamilton and Martha Stegmaier. We're talking about preserving family histories, and we'll continue to do so in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about preserving family histories. We have another one to listen to, Connie. And again, I'll repeat that this is not some major historical event, but something quite different. So why don't you set it up for us?
I'd be happy to. Yes, in the interest of variety, we're going to be hearing a story from Belle Sarah Gage. Belle was a fourth grader at Merrimack Elementary School in the school district of Clayton when she wrote this story. And I do want to note that Belle's story was submitted individually. It wasn't part of a class project. This was something that Belle wanted on her own to do. Her story takes place in the year 2000, which is before she was born, so it is history to her. It took place in St. Louis, Missouri. And it's a fun story that no doubt will live on in her family's history for many years. The title of the story is Toyota Tercel Trouble.
My dad is an environmentalist. In fact, he is the greenest guy I know. He keeps his carbon footprint small as an atom and reuses almost everything. My dad bikes to work every day, wears socks that my dog has chewed till there are no socks, and owned the same car for 21 years. In 1980, he took ownership of that car, a Toyota Corolla Tercel, one of the greenest white cars with blue pinstripes of the time. My dad remembers the car well. He bought it in 12th grade for $6,120 with the money he earned by scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins for 2 years. The beloved car had a stick shift, only two doors, and a hatchback. It traveled 30 miles per gallon, pretty green for back then. My dad drove it to college in Northern California, to medical school in San Diego, to Arizona, and then from Arizona to St. Louis. After 16 years, the car started getting hard to start in cold weather. On freezing days, my dad would spray stinky starting fluid into the carburetor to start the rickety car. A couple of years later, the passenger door broke. It was too expensive to fix, but my dad made the best of the event, and of course, the green guy kept the car. In 2000, my dad drove the 20-year-old car to the dentist. When he parked at the dentist's office, he tried to get out of the aging car, but to my dad's dismay, the driver's door had joined the passenger door in the land of being stuck. "Well, that's all right. I'll just open the window and climb out that way," my dad thought. So he unrolled the driver's window and climbed down. At that point, my dad realized that, Unfortunately, if he didn't want his stereo to be stolen, he would need to close the window. So he reached into the open window, cranked up the window halfway, then pulled his arm out. Then he opened the hatchback, which opened and closed only from the outside, and crawled in. He landed on the seats that were spilling over with foam like a glass of overflowing root beer. Next, he rolled the driver's window up from inside the car, scooted back to the hatchback, climbed out of the hatchback, closed the hatchback, and joyfully marched to his dentist appointment, basking in the pride of his success. After the appointment, which was not as pleasant as he had anticipated, he sighed and then got to work. First, he climbed into the car through the hatchback and then rolled down the driver's window. Next, he climbed out the driver's window, closed the hatchback, climbed back into the car through the open window, rolled up the window from inside the car, and drove away. My dad didn't give away that beloved Toyota Tercel until 2001, when, in addition to becoming donated reusable metal scraps, it had also become the place that an ant colony called home.
Producer Alex Hoyer spoke with Belle after her reading and learned just how excited she was when she had learned that her story was going to be published.
When I found out that my story would be published, I was literally jumping with joy, and it just made me really proud. And I think I called my grandmother and I told her, and just, for lack of a better word, happy.
Have you written other things?
Yes, but this was really my first published story.
What kinds of things do you like to write? Things like this?
I definitely enjoy writing this sort of story, but I really just love to write anything.
What did you learn from writing this?
For one, I learned the story and I got a taste of my dad's personality in a way. Had always known he was extremely environmental, but this just made me realize even more so.
And is that something that you think is important, to be environmentally friendly?
I definitely think so. Yeah. But I don't think that everyone needs to be quite as environmental as him.
Well, that may not rank with emigrating from Warsaw to Ellis Island or Brooklyn, New York, going to the dentist, that is, but it was a sweet story nonetheless. Another very, very mature young lady. And I think, as I remember correctly, she called last year on the program, and she was very excited at that particular time.
Yes, she did. I recall that myself. And as far as the importance of the story, I think it's just the joy and the humor involved, and also the fact that this was, I think, our first story we've ever received that had to do with environmentalism. So it's kind of like we're ushering into the next generation of stories, perhaps. So.
And Fran, another thing I sort of picked up on there is this bonding issue that you mentioned earlier on. There was a sense that it really helped her bond with her father.
Right. The sharing of a story between any ancestor and student really does cement that bond. And it's often a very special thing to the older person for their story to be shared. So they're there are a couple of aspects to that that make it really special.
I'm sure Dad never thought when he was making that trek to the dentist and climbing in and out of that car that it was going to be part of a book one day. Martha, I noticed you were making notes during the course of that recording.
Yeah, you know, I was just writing down some of the vocabulary words that she used, as well as Miles, and, you know, rickety, aging, dismay, basking. She was talking about, for lack of a better word. I think Belle used better words a lot. In St. Louis Public Schools, and I'm sure across really the nation, there is a real emphasis curricularly on rich academic vocabulary. And I think maybe Fran or Connie talked earlier about sometimes you'll be reading this story that was written by, say, a fourth or a fifth grader. You're like, there are echoes of the grandmother's speech or vocabulary. So I think trying to find just the right word to draw a picture for the reader in the reader's mind of the sight, the smell, touch of something is really –
a challenge for the kids that they rise too well in this.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Connie, go ahead.
And that's exactly what we want these students to do, is to listen to their elders and learn from them, not only their experience, but also from their vocabulary. And we've talked so much today about the personal and family benefits of the Granny Annie and the educational aspects. And I just would like to share something that I read on the website of the National Center for Family Literacy, because I think it fits the Granny Annie so perfectly. And the way it was put there is that literacy is at the root of a person's ability to succeed, and the family is at the heart. So it really is a winning combination, family and literacy working hand in hand.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I know you came equipped with a great many stories potentially to read. Do you have one that we can do in just a couple of minutes?
Oh, yes, and I'd be delighted to read it. Audrey Herman sent this story from Ohio, and it's titled Spudnut Saturday. It took place in about 1954 in Tampa, Florida. Back then, in 1954, everything was good in Tampa, Florida. Gas was 20 cents per gallon, candy bars and Coca-Cola were 5 cents, and cars were $1,500. Everybody wanted that kind of stuff. Everybody had a job, too. You either worked with your parents or in the yard or did chores. TV didn't even come on till 4 o'clock p.m. It was always funny, too. No murder shows or survival shows, not to mention it was in black and white. That's when a well-known paperboy got an idea. Every Saturday was payday for the little paper route boy, who was only around 10 years old at the time. He rode around on his Schwinn bike and threw one of his 40 to 45 customers a newspaper. A lady caught him. At first he thought that she was going to yell at him because he had thrown the paper at her bushes, but instead she asked the boy to go buy her a spudnut if she gave him some money. A spudnut is like a donut, but it's made out of potatoes. So he thought, why not? When he came back from the local corner store called Mom and Pop, she gave him a quarter. Back then, a quarter would be like $2 now. The spudnuts didn't cost that much. That's when the little paperboy got an idea. If he sold spudnuts on every Saturday morning, he'd have a fortune. So he did. He wasn't afraid to ask anybody anything. So when he went to deliver his paper to customers, and he asked if they wanted any spudnuts, and most of them said yes. So every Saturday morning, he'd go to the corner store, buy some spud nuts by the dozen, and sell them to his customers. He made about $10 a week and was known as the kid with all the money. His brothers were jealous of him because he had all the money, so when they wanted something, they went to him. The little salesman still works as a salesman at a local car dealership today. That's the story of how my grandpa sold spud nuts to make money.
Well, if you made 10 bucks, I might go into that business myself. Very, very nice. We do have a few minutes left, and we have a caller that wants to get into this conversation. So let's bring Marty in from Spanish Lake. Go ahead, Marty.
Well, I know it's kind of off the subject, but I'm 81 years old, and I've been writing my own story since nobody was interested in taking my story. Growing up in World War II in a two-room school, Lutheran school in North St. Louis, and all the things that went with World War II, I need to know where I can go, first of all, to have the font made larger because it's too small, and I want a booklet, and I have pictures that I want to add. And is there anyone out there that can do something like that for me? I've got it on my Microsoft Word, but I'm not real adept at publishing anything.
Marty, well, I think maybe we have an answer for you. Connie?
Well, I would just like to first congratulate you for writing your story. That's fantastic news. I wish more people would take the time to do that. And then what I would suggest is that you contact us through the Granny Annie, and I can give you some suggestions on how to proceed with your project. Our contact information is on our website, and I guess our website, www.thegrannyannie.org, is...
we'll have a link to it on ours at STL Public. Radio.org, yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'd love to talk to her more about her story.
You know, I was just thinking and listening to Marty here, what an interesting project might be if you had some young kids who could go out and talk and take stories from people like Marty. I'm sure there are many of them out there. Perhaps they're alone. Perhaps they're in nursing homes, but have stories to tell and no one to tell them to.
Well, I believe some schools do projects like that, and I certainly would encourage that as well because, in a sense, we're all family. So let's just hear what each other have to say.
There has to be a treasure trove of information and stories and history out there that is not being recorded, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Martha.
And Don, just really wanting to encourage people who are listening to either themselves and or encourage their friends and relatives to start telling the stories and provide an opportunity for the young people to interview them and to take down their stories because the submission deadline is February 1st.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to next, is what happens for those people who are listening, young people in particular, or parents who would like to guide them this way. How can they get involved for the next publication?
As just mentioned, our annual submission deadline for stories is February 1st. So to be in Volume 9, which will come out next May, we would need to receive your story at the Granny Annie. It has to be postmarked by February 1st. And all the guidelines and the submission forms are online, easily accessible, and there is no fee.
And there are wonderful resources on the website for teachers or anyone who wants to guide the process in terms of interviewing, revising, note-taking. Also, there's an amazing index of all the different topics. So if a student just doesn't know where to begin with the story keeper, this might give them some ideas of the kinds of stories they can tell.
Fran, and going through your website, I noticed that you have a number of volunteers. I suppose, like most organizations, you're always looking for them. What do they do?
Probably the biggest thing they do is to help us select the stories. We have a selection committee of about 20 people, and some of those people, actually most of the people, do this year after year. We have some people who help with graphics. We have some people who help when we have translation issues. Connie, remind me of some other things.
Oh, and also helping with our annual book signing and our art exhibit. And we appreciate all that help from our volunteers. And in addition, we appreciate any support in the way of donations. I mentioned earlier the Missouri Arts Council and the Regional Arts Commission grants, which we appreciate very much, but they are a very small portion of our budget, actually. So donations can be made through our website, and our books are on sale on the website and also at Left Bank Books downtown. So we appreciate in advance support.
Well, we'll remind our listeners once again that February 1st is the deadline for submitting those stories. And all of the information that we've been talking about here today with regard to those donations or volunteers or getting involved in submitting these manuscripts can also be accessed through our website at stlpublicradio.org. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll see you again just about a year from now, and we'll do this again and see how this year's final book turned out.
Great.
Thank you so much, Connie McIntyre, Fran Hamilton, and Martha Stegmar.
Thank you, Don. It has been
great seeing you. Congratulations once again on this project. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, in the next installment of our series, How We Move, we'll talk about Lambert-St. Louis International Airport and its role in economic development, as well as a place where visitors to St. Louis are welcomed and where they also sometimes get their very first impression of our community. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.